missile strike on Syria, this time targeting an area in the south of the capital, Damascus. Iran criticizes the disproportionate representation and influence of Western powers in the UN Security Council. Also ahead, the Daesh terror group says it's been behind the deadly coordinated bombings in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Welcome. Israel has launched two missiles targeting an empty building in the south of the Syrian capital, Damascus. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who gave us the latest on the attack.
The Syrian state news media reported that at about 12:45 a.m. local time here in Damascus, Israel carried out an attack firing two missiles targeting south of Damascus, an area south of Damascus. The state news media outlets did not confirm if those missiles were surface-to-surface missiles or if they were fired from an Israeli fighter jets. However, the direction of the enemy missiles were from the occupied Syrian Golan over there. Of course, according to the media reports, official media reports here, one of the two missiles hit an empty building south of Damascus, while the other was intercepted by Syrian air defenses. Still, there is no official statement that came out from an official military source here or from the foreign ministry yet. Usually, a statement comes out from an official source. We have to wait and see what will come out, if any more details would be disclosed. However, it's definitely not the first time. Almost every week or two, Israel carries out an attack targeting Syrian army positions, whether around the capital Damascus in Syria's south or even in Homs countryside and in the Syria's northeast. Definitely not a surprise for the Syrian army. Israel's an enemy. Usually, the foreign ministry sends letters to the United Nations calling on the international body to shoulder responsibility in forcing Israel to respect sovereign countries and the independence of countries.
The Israeli High Court has rejected, for the fourth time in a row, an appeal for the immediate release of Palestinian administrative detainee Qaed Fasfus. He's facing the risk of sudden death after 125 days of his hunger strike. Qaed Fasfus and four other prisoners are on an open-ended hunger strike to protest their detention. Mona Candil reports from Ramallah.
For the fourth time, the Israeli High Court has rejected an appeal made to release Qaed Fasfus, a Palestinian prisoner whom his health condition is seriously deteriorating due to his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. Al-Fasfus is protesting his imprisonment under Israel's administrative detention without charge or trial. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, who made the appeal, says Al-Fasfus could be minutes away from sudden death, especially after doctors at the Barzilai Medical Center, where he's being hospitalized, said diagnosis showed he developed blood clots.
It's obvious that Israeli authorities want to adopt a new approach in dealing with the hunger strikes against administrative detention. They are exerting force at the utmost. Even if Al-Fasfus or other hunger striking prisoners die, they don't care. Maybe they think this way they will be unfolding this file. We are continuing our efforts and we really hope Al-Fasfus won't die because the repercussions will be out of control inside the jails and outside it.
In addition to Qaed Fasfus, four other prisoners have been refusing to eat, also to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. They are all demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. Weekly protests continue to take place in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners follow the same path in the future.
The Israeli occupation does not know the meaning of humanity. Literally, those prisoners are dying. They must immediately be released. Their detention is illegal in the first place.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention for prolonged periods of time without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds over 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with some 500 of them under the illegal administrative detention. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the only request of Kaid al-Fasfus and other Palestinian hunger-striking prisoners is their freedom and an end to their arbitrary administrative detention. After 125 days of an open-ended hunger strike against Israel's illegal policy, al-Fasfus' family says he would be victorious either through his long-awaited release or martyrdom. Muna Kandil, Occupy Jamallah.
Iran's ambassador to the UN slams the disproportionate representation and power of Western nations in the Security Council.
Currently, the West has a strong presence and influence in the Council. Three of its members have veto power, while the main regions are fully represented in terms of both the number as well as privileges, including veto power. This means inequality among the regions. Likewise, there are many states within a given region that have never found a chance to become a council member, while there are states in the same region that each have served between 10 to 22 years in the council. This means inequality within a region.
Addressing a plenary session of the General Assembly, Majid Takht Ravanchi said the Security Council is facing a credibility crisis and increasing deficiencies. He said the Council must be reformed to ensure equitable rather than geographical representation. The Iranian diplomat also censured the use of sanctions as a collective punishment of entire nations without furthering peace and security. He described the restrictions as blunt and blind instruments that have raised fundamental ethical questions. Earlier on Tuesday, Takht Ravanchi said the Security Council must only exercise its power to impose sanctions as a last resort, if at all necessary.
Chapter 7 functions, including sanctions, must be applied only as a measure of last resort, if necessary, and after all means of peaceful settlement of disputes have been exhausted. In discharging its functions, the Council must accord priority to prevention and resorting to non-coercive measures under Charter's Chapter 6.
The Iranian envoy criticized the Council's, quote, frequent, hasty, and excessive invocation of coercive measures set out in Chapter 7. He said the practice has complicated the situation and resulted in violations of sovereignty and territorial integrity of states and abuses of human rights. Takht Ravanchi said the Council must instead give priority to prevention and resorting to non-coercive measures under Chapter 6 of the UN Charter. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for coordinated suicide bombings that rocked the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The three attackers are said to have been Ugandan. Six people lost their lives in the blasts, including the bombers. Two police officers are among the victims. Several dozen were also injured, five of them critically. The explosions, which took place minutes apart close to the Ugandan parliament building, sent the lawmakers running for cover. The incident comes less than a month after a similar bomb attack claimed by Daesh killed one and injured three others in Kampala. Political scientist Mr. Wilmer Leon believes that the United States has used the UN Security Council to act like a hegemon, but more and more countries are starting to oppose this approach.
Look at the number of UN resolutions that have condemned the Zionist state of Israel as it deals with the Palestinians, and how those resolutions just get totally ignored primarily because the United States stands in the way of having those resolutions enforced. It's also important to look at the sanction regime that the United States employs at a whim. So, you know, one has to ask oneself, when Nicaragua engages in peaceful, honest elections and the United States imposes sanctions on Nicaragua, how is a peaceful election in Nicaragua a threat to peace? The United States has decided that because it is a global imperial hegemon and it is still operating in the mindset of a unipolar world, that it can impose its will on anyone at any time for any reason. And now Iran and China and Russia and Nicaragua and Venezuela, they're all saying, not anymore.
Polish security forces confront migrants who have been stranded at the Poland-Belarus border for days now. Security forces fired water cannons at a group of angry migrants who were throwing rocks from across the border. Thousands of migrants, mostly from the Middle East, are currently camped at the EU's external border in Belarus. Polish government estimates that around 1,500 people are en masse there. The asylum seekers are hoping to cross the border. Poland and Lithuania are pushing them back, leaving them behind barbed wires amid freezing temperature. At least 8 of them have already died, and fears are growing for the safety of others. Russia's foreign minister has accused Poland of violating international humanitarian laws, describing the crackdown against migrants by Polish forces as completely unacceptable.
The behavior of the Polish side is completely unacceptable. I think the water cannons and tear gas and shots over the migrants' heads toward Belarus state, all of it reflects a desire to hide their own actions. And they cannot but understand that they violate all thinkable norms of the international humanitarian law and other international law norms.
Lavrov also criticized the EU for its double standards regarding the migrant crisis, adding that such approaches put the bloc in a bad position. Their reaction comes as the EU is accusing Belarus of pushing the migrants to the border to get concessions from the bloc in retaliation for sanctions. NATO has also accused Minsk of putting the lives of migrants at risk, offering support for Warsaw. The Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, however, says his country does not want confrontation with the EU and that the issue of migrants stranded at the Poland-Belarus border should not lead to clashes with the bloc. Armenia says a ceasefire has been announced on its eastern border with Azerbaijan following renewed clashes there. Armenia's defense ministry says Russia has angered the ceasefire agreement. The true status comes hours after the country reported the death of 15 soldiers in the last border flare-up. Azerbaijan had accused Armenia of provoking the clash and said two of its soldiers were also wounded. Meanwhile, the UN urged the warring sides to exercise restraint and address the issue through dialogue. The two neighbors have been locked in a bitter conflict over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh for decades now. They fought a 44-day war over the region late last year. Russia has maintained a peacekeeping force in Nagorno-Karabakh since the war. The United States says it'll look for ways to prevent Nicaragua from obtaining funds from international financial institutions. The U.S. State Department's top Latin American official announced the decision after a Nicaraguan election that Washington has denounced as a sham. Brian Nichols said he will work with the Treasury Department to try to prevent President Daniel Ortega's government from getting further access to international lending. Washington has imposed an entry ban on Ortega, his vice president's wife, and members of his cabinet following the November 7th election. Last week, incumbent Ortega won the presidential election, clinching his fourth consecutive term in office. Political analyst Yamir Chabur says the U.S. wants to punish Nicaraguan people for re-electing a president for the fourth consecutive time.
Yes, this is another way that the United States is trying to meddle in a sovereign nation within Latin America. This is basically continuing the policy of economic warfare, of sanctions, of illegal unilateral coercive measures, trying to punish the population in Nicaragua because they decided to vote for Daniel Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo for a themselves. But, I mean, that's the choice of the people of Nicaragua. This is their country. They have their own sovereignty, which they've been able to achieve since the 1979 popular Sandinista revolution, where they ousted a U.S.-backed dictator, Anastasio Somoza.
At least one person dies in torrential rains and ensuing mudslides in Canada's western province of British Columbia. Canadian police say they have recovered the body of a woman near the Lillooet community north of Vancouver. There are fears that the fatalities will rise. Rescue operations are underway for at least two missing persons. Rains that have been pouring since Friday let up on Tuesday. The floods, mudslides, and debris have blocked roads to Vancouver, trapping hundreds of motorists and sweeping their cars off the road. All rail access to the Port of Vancouver, which is Canada's largest, has also been cut. The incident is threatening the shipment of grain and coal across the country. All right, that's it.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Days after the indictment of former White House advisor Steve Bannon, Adam Schiff, a senior Democrat, warned on Sunday, 14th of November, criminal charges are possible for more associates of former U.S. President Donald Trump, who refused to cooperate with the House committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol attack. We're prepared for you an article written by Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, Bannon May Not Be the Only Trump Ally Indicted Over Capitol Attack. days after the indictment of former White House advisor Steve Bannon. A senior Democrat warned on Sunday, 14th of November, that criminal charges are possible for more associates of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Those who refused to cooperate with the House committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol attack. Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee and a member of the panel investigating the deadly Capitol riot, also said some witnesses could be offered immunity in exchange for testimony in order to advance the inquiry. He told NBC's Meet the Press, he believed without a doubt that the Justice Department decision to charge Steve Bannon with contempt of Congress would shake loose defiant Trump associates. That could include the former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who did not show up for a deposition before the House Select Committee on Friday, 12th of November, shortly before Steve Bannon's indictment was announced. Adam Schiff said, now that witnesses see that if they don't cooperate, if they don't fulfill their lawful duty when subpoenaed, that they too may be prosecuted, it will have a very strong focusing effect on their decision-making. He added, even before the Justice Department acted, it influenced other witnesses who were not going to be Steve Bannon. Adam Schiff added, when ultimately witnesses decide, as Mark Meadows has, that they're not even going to bother showing up, that they have that much contempt for the law, then it pretty much forces our hand and will move quickly. Adam Schiff would not be drawn on whether that meant the committee would issue a criminal contempt referral for Mark Meadows, who, unlike Steve Bannon, was a government employee on 6th of January 2021. But he said the panel would decide quickly and that it wanted to make sure we have the strongest possible case to present to the Justice Department and for the Justice Department to present to a grand jury. Mark Meadows' lawyer has said his client will not appear before the committee unless compelled to do so by a judge. Adam Schiff conceded that certain witnesses, whom he did not identify, could receive limited immunity instead of criminal referral in exchange for their cooperation. The decisions to be made on a case-by-case basis. He said, with certain specific witnesses, we ought to consider it. He added, but as that kind of immunity makes it very difficult to prosecute not just them, but sometimes others, we need to think about it very carefully. Adam Schiff said he saw the developments as an early test of whether our democracy was recovering from the turmoil of the Trump administration. He added, basically, the Republican Party at the top levels, that is Donald Trump and those around him, seem to feel that they're above the law and free to thwart the law. And there's something admirable about thumbing your nose at the institutions of our government. Adam Schiff noted, Steve Bannon did what he did because for 4 years, that's what worked. They could hold Republican Party conventions on the White House grounds. They could fire inspectors general. They could retaliate against whistleblowers. It was essentially a lawless presidency, and they were proud of it. That ought to concern every American. We need a reestablishment of the rule of law in this country, and I'm glad to see that is happening now. Bannon's indictment and the threat of charges for Mark Meadows marked a significant escalation in the House committee's efforts to get to the bottom of the 6th of January riot and Donald Trump's attempt to overturn a defeat by Joe Biden. Trump himself is locked in legal battle with the committee over the release of White House documents related to the day of the insurrection, when his supporters ransacked the Capitol building. On Thursday, 11th of November, a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. handed Donald Trump a temporary victory by blocking the release by the National Archives of hundreds of pages of communication logs, memos, and other materials ordered by a lower court just days before. The appeals court will listen to arguments later this month on Donald Trump's claim that the documents are protected by executive privilege before making a final decision. Adam Schiff said he believed efforts to delay the inquiry in the courts of law would not succeed. He said, "The courts of law themselves have recognized that Donald Trump essentially played our institutions for 4 years and played rope-a-dope in the courts." Adam Schiff added, "They moved with such expedition to reject Trump's claims in the district court a week or so ago. Now the Court of Appeals is saying they're going to have a hearing by the end of the month. Courts don't generally move that fast, and I think it's a recognition that Donald Trump has relied on justice delayed, meaning justice denied. So we and the courts of law are moving quickly." Meanwhile, in another development, a senior Senate Republican refused four times on Sunday, 14th of November, to condemn Donald Trump for defending supporters who chanted "Hang Mike Pence" during the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January. Donald Trump made the comments about his vice president, who did not yield to pressure to overturn Joe Biden's election victory, in an interview with ABC's chief Washington correspondent, Jonathan Carl. John Barroso of Wyoming, the third-ranking Republican in the Senate, appeared on ABC's This Week program. He was asked, "Can your party tolerate a leader who defends murderous chants against his own vice president?" John Barroso of Wyoming replied, "Well, let me just say the Republican Party is incredibly united right now, and I think the more that the Democrats and the press become obsessed with President Trump, I think the better it is for the Republican Party. President Trump brings lots of energy to the party. He's an enduring force." He also said the party was focused on elections and policy debate, not the past. His host, George Stephanopoulos, said, "So you have no problem with the president saying, 'Hang Mike Pence' is common sense." John Barroso added, "I was with Mike Pence in the Senate chamber during 6th of January, and what happened was they quickly got Vice President Pence out of there, certainly a lot faster than they removed the senators. I believe he was safe the whole time." John Barroso added, "I didn't hear any of these chants. I don't believe that he did either, and Vice President Pence came back into the chamber that night and certified the election." George Stephanopoulos said, "We just played the chance. I'm asking you if you can tolerate the president saying 'Hang Mike Pence' is common sense," before pivoting to Trump's lie that the election was subject to widespread voter fraud. John Barroso said, "It's not common sense."
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio is our friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi, from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum Assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Sayyid, in our day and age, we constantly see multiple and very, subhanAllah, weird, I might say, and new plagues, diseases, and illnesses going around. Like, for example, in these past 5-6 years, we had Ebola in Africa, if you remember how many people died. And then we had Zika, the Zika virus in Brazil, and many more people died. And then now we have Corona, and many people are dying. So all of these diseases and waba, as you call them in Arabic, plagues, are these a sign of the end times? Are these a sign of the reappearance of the awaited Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala farajuhu sharif? Or are they just a fact of life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, that's true. We can see many viruses or diseases spreading in the world. For example, there was a disease, SARS.
SARS as well, right.
You know, we were not getting any letters because they used to say that some people, like from special country,
right,
they're sending SARS through the envelopes and these and that.
Right.
We had these issues as well, and there are many other things.
Right.
Now, when we talk about these things, we cannot just say these are the signs of the Akhirah or, you know, the end of the world. Rather, these are, I'm trying to find a good word for it because it has a very bad wording if I want to use the actual wording for this.
A part
but
of
obviously,
life?
No. It's something which is created by humans. You know, the mist which is made by humans.
Right.
Well, if I want to use the actual
that we have done on Earth,
yes,
and in the
American or in the British, you know, the way they use like this mess of mankind, they use other words, but obviously we don't want to use
ourselves, climate change,
yeah,
fossil fuel,
so
all of these things.
This facade, this corruption that we see, it's because of the human beings. They are very much interrupting into the nature, and they are basically destroying the nature. The way ozone layer is getting, you know,
it was
harmed,
damaged
obviously,
because
yes,
of
it
the
is
carbon
is
emissions.
It's damaging
right,
because of the human beings. You know, now
global
we
warming.
Have less trees. We have global warming is obviously increasing. The amount of garbage that we have, the amount of noise,
right,
the sound noise that we create, the pollution, obviously.
Right.
The pollution is not just about the carbon. It's about the noise pollution as well. And, you know, the stress that we release from ourselves. All these things are the factors that are making or changing this world into such a situation. And
right,
the amount of, you know, the laboratories, the way they are examining different things, and every day they come up with a new virus. And then, although they don't have it, either they have the antivirus or they do not have. Allah
right,
knows it.
Right.
But obviously, we need to see our own actions as a human being, that what is our responsibility, because Islam itself talks about the justice, and it talks about the justice in all fields. If I'm living in an environment, how justly can I live so that I'm not damaging the environment surrounding me?
Right.
It includes the trees, it includes the plants. I don't know if our listeners knows that, you know, cutting a tree in Islam has the orders of killing a man, because tree is alive. According to some traditions, it is said when you cut a tree, it means that you have killed a man, a human being.
Right.
So it is just equivalent to killing a human being. And now we can see, like, in the jungles, there are many people who are cutting, and today
we have the Amazon jungle.
Yes, and today we have come to this thing that we should work without papers, by texts or emails and all those, like paper-free,
right,
basically,
or at least
movement
sustainable
that we have. Yes,
right.
This is a good movement. But obviously, we can also see that, you know, last year, because of coronavirus, when we had less activities outside, there were less cars, less can say, like public was communicating or traveling,
right,
or harming the nature, we could see that the nature was revived,
right,
realived. There were many rivers which had more water than before. The plants we had grown more than before. So it had an effect on the nature. And this is, I think, this is some of the signs, which basically these are the alarming signs that tells us, that warns us, that look, you messed up the whole world. Now for a year when you had a break, you can see how nature came back.
Right.
How the nature had recovered, yes,
right,
itself. So we need to be very much careful. Now, the issue is, you know, in the Islamic world and obviously non-Islamic world, because everyone is worried about the death and the, you know, last age,
right,
that they say it's the end of the world.
Right.
We can
times.
See many movies like, for example, like it was 2012,
end
of the world, and
right,
then we have Dune now coming up.
Right. Remember the Mayan calendar that ended in 2012, everybody thought the world is going to end.
Yes. So we had many movies made on this.
Right.
Why? Because we are worried about hereafter. We are
right,
worried about the end of this world. And this being worried is more from the secular system, from those who have material mentality, who
right,
are following the material view, worldview.
Because in their view, their
yes,
existence is tied
according
to the,
according to their
world,
view, yes, the death is the end of everything.
Right.
And there is nothing after it. It's the existence and non-existence. So with the death, they think they do not exist anymore.
Right.
Whereas in the Islamic school of thought, in the other religions, there is another world after this world. And we are transferring, with the death, we transfer from this material world to something which is metaphysic, to something which is beyond this world. And that is the continuation of our journey, basically. So therefore, we are not very much worried about this. Rather, we are worried that when we die, we should die with having good deeds.
Right.
In our book of deeds.
Because right, we know
not
we're going
the,
somewhere.
Yes, not the bad deeds. So
right,
we should die in a way that we were useful for this world, for the environment, for our family, for the
right,
society, and we were amongst those who will be known as good people, not the evil.
Right.
So this is what we think.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, on the other hand, obviously, we have many narrations there. The things have been said in the books as well. There were the people who used to talk about or tell about the future. They have said that, obviously, that when the end of the world will come, obviously, the people will die. And there are many other signs. So all these things are in the narrations, and we have it. Either the people will die due to, you know, the
are
messed
these,
up.
Sorry, sorry to interrupt. Are these correct narrations?
No, I'm just talking about general narrations.
So we have, okay.
Yeah,
right,
we have. Obviously, all these things are happening, these wordings that spread amongst
right,
the people that these diseases are, for the last time, obviously, the earth will go, the world will go to the end. There are many
right,
different movies. I don't know, for the recent movies. There are many which are talking about the disease. Some movies
right,
are made on the coronavirus, and then people are isolated into their homes or lands.
Right.
There are some, obviously, who are struggling for a living.
Right.
So all these
right,
things we can see in the media, obviously.
Right.
When
especially war is going to
yes,
end the world, nuclear
the
war and so on.
It's
right,
not the nuclear war anymore. Like, no one's going to use it because
right,
we ourselves have made so many, you know, diseases and these
right,
things, so which really
that's what people fear most now. Right.
So all these things are there. I'm just telling about some of the other narrations so that,
right,
you know, we should be aware that why these things are made, why such things are said, it is based on some of the narrations like this.
Right.
Like there is a narration. Now, but on the other side, when we talk about the end of the world, obviously we know that in the Islamic studies or according to the Islamic teachings, we know that the end of the world will happen after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, for
right.
whom we are waiting.
That's certain.
Right. And obviously the whole world will be changed into a peaceful world the way it is corrupted now.
Right.
It is said, like in the narrations, there is a verse as well in the Quran that before the Imam Mahdi comes, the whole world will sink in the corruption.
Be filled with corruption.
It will be filled with
sadness.
The corruption, and then when he comes, he will change the world,
right.
and he will bring justice to the world, and everyone will reach or go towards the perfection. Basically, the journey of perfection will start, and they will quickly reach to the perfection. Obviously, we are still at the journey of perfection.
Right.
So these are the narrations that we have for the end of the world, and after he dies or get martyred, after that there will be the end of the world. Also, we have narration that if on this world, if there are only two people left or remained alive in this world, they should know that one of them is Imam Mahdi and another is an ordinary man. So up till here we have these
right.
narrations. But as far as it is referred to these viruses, to these illnesses, diseases that are spreading, it is because of the mess that we have made to this world, and we are far away from the healthy foods, the original, you know, thing that we used
right.
to eat, and we have these industrial, you know, made chemical made things, and due to which obviously our immune system is obviously it's getting weaker and weaker.
Right. And that sobering thought, we will unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank the dear Sayyid for his time today and for his insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in.
لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
President Biden took office pledging to rescind the Trump administration's deliberately harsh policies towards migrants who show up at America's doorstep. But as Joe Biden's first year in office draws to a close, his administration continues to lean heavily on one of those policies. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, "It's time to end the pandemic emergency at the border." The administration says that Border Patrol agents are simply following orders from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, that were put in place to keep the country safe from COVID-19. But there is little doubt that the administration has used the policy as a stopgap measure to quickly remove migrants who are gathering at the southern border in large numbers. Pushed by the economic fallout from COVID in South and Central America, and pulled by rumors of lenient treatment under a more welcoming American president, among other factors. On Friday, 12th of November, congressional investigators released excerpts from testimony by a former senior CDC official who admitted that there was little public health rationale for instituting the policy since the coronavirus was already spreading in the United States by the time the Title 42 order was signed. Border control agents have had close to 2 million encounters with migrants at the border so far in 2021, nearly twice as many as in 2019, and almost four times as many as in 2018. More than a million of this year's encounters ended with migrants being deported or turned away under Title 42. Although the Biden administration has carved out some humanitarian exceptions to Title 42, unaccompanied children, for instance, its continued defense of the policy has horrified activists, international agencies, and even some officials serving within the Biden administration. Two left their posts in recent months after making scathing critiques. That's because the use of Title 42 essentially makes it impossible for migrants who fear for their lives to claim asylum, even at ports of entry, and returns many to squalid camps in Mexico, where they are vulnerable to violence and threats from smugglers and cartels. Under U.S. law, anyone who sets foot on American soil is entitled to express a fear of violence and persecution in their home country, setting off a process that can take years to resolve in backlogged courts. Title 42 effectively short-circuits that process and allows for immediate removal. people in the Department of Homeland Security are frustrated that a large number of migrants who are caught sneaking across the border are simply sent back to Mexico, where they regroup and try their luck in another day. Both the Trump administration and the Biden administration used Title 42 to quickly expel unlawful border crossers instead of arresting and prosecuting them. Under the policy, there's little cost to trying to sneak across again and again. As many as half of single adults expelled under Title 42 try to cross the border unlawfully again. That's one reason the number of encounters has been so high this year. Still, many border agents consider Title 42 a powerful tool to control the unusually high number of people trying to cross the border unlawfully, and they're not eager to relinquish it. The result has been the worst of both worlds. The Biden administration finds itself under fire from both the left and the right for its handling of migrants at America's border with Mexico. The chorus of criticism reached new heights in September when images surfaced of more than 10,000 Haitians camping under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas, and getting chased by Border Patrol agents on horseback. Opinion polls suggest that the Biden administration is particularly mistrusted on immigration, with one showing that 34% of Democrats and 73% of independents disapprove of how the southern border has been handled. What is broken at the border didn't break in the past few months. It has been broken for years. It will take time and help from Congress to fix it. But the Biden administration must work harder to turn a system that is too often chaotic, arbitrary, and even deadly into one that is more orderly and fair. The American people want a secure border where people enter lawfully, where criminals are arrested, and where people who are in genuine fear for their lives are afforded a chance to apply for political asylum. Some say that Title 42 bought the administration time to rebuild the infrastructure for processing migrants that was dismantled under the former Trump administration. But Title 42 must end, not only because it is morally and legally questionable, but also because the COVID-19 pandemic is receding. As the border opens up to vaccinated tourists, and as it becomes possible to test and vaccinate migrants at ports of entry, the rationale for its use is evaporating. A federal judge ordered an end to the use of Title 42 as applied to family units in September, but the Biden administration appealed that decision. It is time to put a more permanent policy in place. The Biden administration has taken some important steps in that direction. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, the first immigrant to hold the post, is seeking to utilize asylum officers who can adjudicate claims more efficiently than judges. This change, which is based on a plan developed by the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute, should help whittle down the enormous backlog of cases. The Biden administration has also opened important discussions with partners in Latin America to develop a regional strategy towards mass migration. While it needs to play a part, the United States is not the only possible destination for refugees. Other countries have played a crucial role in providing opportunities for those escaping hardship, natural disaster, and violence. Colombia, for example, has extended temporary legal status to more than a million Venezuelans who were fleeing economic collapse, a commendable policy that allows them to work legally. Brazil, for example, gave work permits to about 98,000 Haitians after the earthquake in Haiti. And Chile has granted permanent residence to about 70,000 Haitians. But the economic fallout from the pandemic made the lives of Haitians in those countries even more precarious and prompted a backlash against them. President Sebastián Piñera of Chile tightened border controls and visa rules and cracked down on illegal immigration in Chile. That caused many to uproot their lives and travel north towards the border with Texas, where Haitians and Venezuelans are showing up in unprecedented numbers. Many of the Haitians who camped out under the bridge in Del Rio, Texas in September had built lives in South America before making the journey to the U.S. border with Mexico. Under U.S. law, people who are already firmly resettled in another country are not eligible for political asylum. But immigration lawyers say a temporary work permit with no path to permanent legal residency in Chile and Brazil should not disqualify Haitians from seeking a permanent safe haven in the United States. Nonetheless, roughly 8,500 Haitians who arrived at the Texas border have been deported to Port-au-Prince in Haiti, a city that is already struggling with fuel shortages, widespread violence, and a political crisis. It would be far more humane to send them back to Chile or to Brazil. American officials should offer more financial and logistical support, as well as more COVID-19 vaccines to countries that agree to resettle migrants. Mass migration, like the pandemic and climate change, can only be addressed by working collaboratively with our neighbors. Lastly, expanding legal pathways for migrants to apply from their own countries for permission to work seasonally or live in the United States could give people hope that if they wait their turn, they will be rewarded. That could help stem the tide of migrants making the dangerous trek north.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.